This is URN The Pulse.
Today's stories, we have got a development on Brexit, we have British coal power plants closing, and we've got a China mall installing nurseries for husbands. But first, of course, we've got to address the biggest story of today, which is Donald Trump winning the election. And Stefan's going to deal with this one, aren't you?
Indeed I am. President Trump, roll that around your mind for a bit, because we're going to be hearing a lot about that in the coming years. As I'm sure you're all aware, Donald Trump marked the end of a divisive and vitriolic campaign with success, as he wins the election to become the 45th President of the United States. With uncomfortable similarity to our own Brexit referendum, he defied polls and popular opinion by vanquishing Hillary Clinton, who many had thought was fated for the White House. Both have given their post-election speeches, with Trump magnanimously proclaiming the future of a united America, while Clinton has, as of a few minutes ago, graciously conceded defeat and asked voters to let Trump have a chance to lead. And the main question now for the entire world is, what's next? He may have won, but there's so much we don't know about his policies. All that we wish just aren't true. The focus is already turning to the international reaction. The global financial market today experienced quite a heavy loss before fixing itself slightly. At the same time, leaders around the world offer their congratulations, albeit slightly muted, as many had criticised Trump before. One such leader is Theresa May. As this new anti-establishment era dawns, pressure is on her fledgling government to ensure that the UK-US relationship remains as strong as ever, especially if we find ourselves without friends post-Brexit. They might bond over their leadership of populations rejecting establishment and globalism, but that's just another unknown. Now, none of us here are political analysts, and even the professionals have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. I think we should just give it a go anyway. Do any of you guys see our relationship with the US getting any closer in the future?
Go on, Lewis.
We've got to try, haven't we? We've decided quite, well, they say emphatically, I'm not sure I quite agree with that particular adjective, but we've decided that we don't want to be part of the European Union anymore. We are wanting to look outwards in terms of our trade deals, in terms of our how we're going to conduct business abroad, how we're going to conduct our diplomacy abroad. The special relationship, as it's termed, has always been somewhat important to every prime ministerial administration, but I think in such a unpredictable and uncertain future, the power behind the American economy and the American political machine will probably still make it a good bet to want to place your chips on, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, well, with Donald Trump in, at least we can look at maybe the relations with Russia strengthening. And that, I mean, I don't want to say it, but that could be another possible trade deal if we still become close with Trump's America. So we've got to look at it that way, I guess. I know everyone in the studio today is feeling quite somber. But I think if you look at the elections, the way that Trump has triumphed, it's quite incredible what he's achieved, especially against all odds. And it's exactly what we were saying at Brexit. Oh my gosh, how's this happened? But I'm really impressed with how he's run his campaign. I think in terms of us going forward, we have to respect that he has won. As Piers Morgan was shouting on GMB this morning, like, we've just got to move on now and just get on with it. And I think that is actually quite true. I don't tend to agree with Piers Morgan, but I do on this case. I think we do have to move on and just look to the future now. I mean, it's not really our country that has to deal with Donald Trump, really, out of the wide spectrum. We just have to deal with him versus trade and things like that. So we're okay.
Well, I think part of the issue is that, like it or not, America is the most influential country in the world. And with someone completely unknown and untested, who's never had any political experience before in his life, being the head of that country, being the most powerful person in the world, we definitely need to look at this very carefully and make sure that we do get the best deal for us. Because as has been mentioned, we do need good deals. Part of the issue with Trump being in charge is that he's repeatedly said America first, and he's kind of had undertones of isolationism and I think it was Americanism or something, basically putting America first and making not having that large of an impact on the world anymore. Yeah. And that's part of what people voted for him well, it's why people voted for him.
I mean, that he did say that UK would be first in the queue.
He didn't say first. He said not the back of the queue, which is what Obama said.
But. Yes. Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to hear what you think. If you want to text in while we're talking about this subject, because we'd love to hear your comments so we can talk about them as well, at EuroN1350 on Twitter or Facebook, or at www.euroN1350.net. Now, guys, I'd like to talk about how people must be feeling waking up this morning and finding out that half the people will be like, oh my gosh, half our country has voted for somebody like Trump. And then the other half, we've got to think about the people that, as Michael Moore was stating actually before the election, how people felt that they'd lost their livelihoods because all they knew was manufacturing, for example, in the South. And this, they saw Trump as a revolutionary figure, a little bit like Brexit, and followed that. And now in hope, they're putting all their hopes in Trump and how they must be feeling and what you think there will be like afterwards.
I mean, it is part of the wider pattern with Brexit, because the campaigns have been remarkably similar.
It's true.
The reasons behind the votes, I mean, obviously we're still sort of putting together the picture of what happened last night, but in terms of why this has come about, it has all been about the sentiments that Brexit shows. And I think for the people that did vote for Donald Trump, they were it's the first time they felt really that someone spoke for their views, that was candid enough to be and brave enough to go up against so many people that were saying that it was wrong, that they can't think that, whatever. Yeah. Whether they are right or not, whether the people saying that it's wrong to say that are right or not, they felt as though they were represented for the first time in a long time. So I would imagine for the people that woke up, or the people that were staying up all night to watch Donald Trump become president-elect, I'd imagine it would be euphoric. It's the first time that my vote or their vote counted for something. So, I mean, I can, as much as I really don't, I can't abide the things that Trump stands for in terms of the way that he's done his campaign, I understand and I sympathise and want to, or hope that we can find solutions for the people that did vote for them, because they did have legitimate reasons that weren't necessarily as evil or as vitriolic as maybe we've painted them for the past 18 months.
I mean, it's been mentioned that the Trump victory is a victory for those against the establishment, but most importantly, a victory for working class people. Yeah. If you look at the demographics, those are resoundingly the people who have voted for Donald Trump. It's white men who don't have a higher education of some kind, the working class. And these are a group of people who must have felt quite marginalized over the past few years. Whether it's justified or not, that's part of the sentiment in America. And they must be waking up and feeling, as you say, euphoric. But what I think is quite interesting is the people who wake up and have found out that half their country doesn't share the same progressive liberal values that they do. I was woken up at 4 o'clock this morning by three of my friends angrily Facebook messaging me, telling me, because these guys live in America, telling me like they can't believe what's going on and they understand how I felt about Brexit. And I think it's, considering there's so many more people in America, it must be quite a lot more jarring almost.
Yeah. Go on, Becky.
Sorry, I think in terms of reactions, but it is remarkably similar to Brexit, because like Lewis and Stefan were saying, people feel like they are being represented, but it wasn't the young people who voted Trump in. I saw this map, and had it been just the young people, the millennials voting, then it would have been remarkably democratic, just like we'd have voted to stay in the European Union. So I think the young people are feeling not represented, really.
Yeah, this is the same divisive problem that this type of voting can have, really. Do you think... How do you think America can deal with the hate crimes that will likely follow, like they did after Brexit? How do you think Donald Trump can give the message out, and Hillary Clinton alike, give the message out to, you know, stand together and not follow what happened after Brexit?
I mean, what I'm worried about is that he won't. If you look at what he said during his rallies, look at what his, not even like just private thoughts, his public opinions and his campaign promises, they've all been borderline racist, if not actually racist, and at the very least, very, very inflammatory. And that's part of the reason why there have been instances of violence at his rallies, is because he's very much inciting that. Not directly saying, punch this man, but I can't think of any particular
apparently
quotes.
He urged his supporters to punch each other in one of the rallies, so he actually did urge people to punch each other.
Now he's not even trying to compete with anyone. He's got what he wants, so he can be exactly whoever he is, and that's part of the worry. We don't know exactly
how far he'll go.
Exactly, yeah. We don't know what he'll be like as a politician. Maybe he'll temper himself. Maybe other people will temper him. Maybe he won't. Maybe just nothing will happen.
I don't know if you guys saw his victory speech this morning, but it was such a different tone from everything that we'd seen in the past 18 months that's come out of his mouth. It was conciliatory. It was an active effort to say we need to come together as a united country, whether or not that works, or whether or not he means it, none of the matter. But what I worry about is that he's not just incited this, but the vote that has happened and the fact that he has been elected and that we have a person in the White House that says this is okay endorses this sort of violence. It's almost encouraging it to the point where we won't do anything about it. Or he was supporting the violence with the police, wasn't he? He wasn't coming out against the people that the police had killed unlawfully or whatever. And if that continues, that sets a very dangerous precedent. That means he is implicitly endorsing such violence or allowing that such deep racial divides or deep tensions can manifest themselves as violence.
I know a lot of people this morning on the talk shows were saying that, especially black citizens who were sat there on the panel, were saying that they were afraid. They were afraid. And they felt that this was a really dangerous leader. Do you think Hillary Clinton can give some hope towards that? Do you think she can still, you know, have a little bit of a spokesperson role to try and calm the panic?
So I do feel quite bad for Hillary Clinton. Obviously, she's put a lot of effort into this and her entire political career. But at the same time, she was up against possibly one of the least liked Republican candidates in history.
Yeah.
One of the most divisive and vitriolic people who run for president. And she didn't win. And I think a lot of the people who did vote for her, a considerable amount at least, would be voting against Trump. And now that's not worked, I wonder what kind of support she actually has. It has been commented that she's not a very charismatic person. She's not like Barack Obama was.
Mm.
So maybe that means she won't be able to drum up the kind of support she needs to counter the prevailing attitudes which might come about as a result of this election.
Liz, you watched her speech just now, didn't you?
Concession
speech. What was she like in that?
Gracious in defeat. She knew she'd been beaten. She knew that she was responsible for making sure that the people that fought for the values that her campaign fought for wouldn't stop now. And I know I felt it when Brexit happened. I felt everything that I believed in, everything that I wanted to fight for, and what I believed Britain was about vanished in one vote. And I think Hillary made a very important statement saying that the people that the values that we share and the values that you believe America holds closest and should endorse, you should never give up the fight to maintain that and fight for what's right. Beyond this speech, I don't know what else she can do. I mean, it has been well noted that she hasn't particularly been popular. It has been an anti-Trump vote because beyond the primaries, because there was no other viable candidate for them. We want to be able to say we need to find new voices, people that can fill this void, that can continue this fight, the fight for these values that they believe in and want to take back the White House and put pressure in Congress, etc. But if of all the voices that we had in 2016, the only person we could find was Hillary Clinton, this with all of this electoral baggage.
Mm.
What I struggle to see how in the next couple of years there can be a recovery without resorting to people, the old guard.
So quickly, in terms of replacements for Trump after 4 years in office, do you think Michelle Obama, who have already been calling for to stand, would be a good Democratic opposition?
I don't know. What kind of political background does she have? I mean,
she's a Harvard lawyer, isn't she? And she used to be a hospital executive in, I think, in Illinois, in Chicago, I think.
She's a very light potential candidate. She's very light across America.
She's got better credentials than Trump had. So
it's very true.
I know he might be getting on a bit as 4 years rolls around, but Joe Biden was also quite often mentioned as a possible, unfortunately, replacement for Hillary this election. And while he probably will be a bit too old, he will be 77 in 2020. I can't think of anyone else who's got such a broad range of experiences in the White House. And actually, he was vice president. That must count for something, more than being a businessman should.
Yeah, so Joe Biden for president in 2020?
Anyone but Trump again.
Maybe not Kanye West, though, hey?
Right. Anyone but Trump again.
Hi, I'm Lillian Greenwood. I'm the Labour MP for Nottingham South, and you're listening to URN.
So now we get to Becky with a story about British coal power plants closing.
The last coal power station is actually scheduled to close by 2022. This is in order to wake May for cleaner and more renewable energy sources. So this is part of the government's wider plan to phase out fossil fuels completely and use more renewable sources such as gas. Ministers have promised last year that all coal power stations would be closed within the decade, but this projection has been pushed forward by campaigners after officials admitted that the last coal power stations should close its doors by 2022. This process has already been completed in Scotland. The last coal-fired power station was actually closed in March this year. So, as I've mentioned, renewable energy is now set to be the primary energy source, receiving many in the Parliament. At the moment, the UK relies on 8 coal power stations to supply electricity, but the coal power is estimated to drop by 66% by the end of 2016. Pressure groups have applauded this government policy, claiming coal is the fuel of the past, as shown by the falling market. However, this has actually affected the area where I live. So Rugeley Power Station was set to close in line with the government's predictions, but it was decommissioned in June this year instead. People aren't necessarily happy about it, actually, because 121 jobs at least have been cut, and another 30 are predicted to go by the time that this station's demolished completely. So what do we think about this? Because obviously the social implications of it are going to be catastrophic, but the environmental ones are going to be really good. So do we think it weighs out?
I mean, if we're lucky, those jobs lost will then go into other areas of energy, for example, renewable energy. I mean, surely as one fades down, the other will increase in power. And I think this is actually particularly pertinent because last week was the Paris Agreement, which was the global climate change agreement. So hopefully we see more of the same of this kind of action over the coming years. I'm not actually sure. I've not really followed energy too much here, but I think any progress we can make is good progress.
Yeah, obviously I don't know your area. I've not got any connection to
all areas in general.
I've got specific to your case, I've got no connection with your town and the people that work there. So for me, in my opinion, it's a brilliant thing to hear. Coal is an old-fashioned way of finding fuel. There's so many more alternatives that are so much more energy efficient and good for the planet. So I'm welcoming the fact that they are getting rid of the power plants that really are really not very nice to look at as well. So at least they'll improve your town looks wise. But yeah, no, I agree with Stefan there. I think surely, and if they don't, this is something that the government has done wrong. They don't provide jobs, replacement jobs, in the new energy sector. I don't understand why they wouldn't. And if they would, then the petition is very, very worth having there.
I mean, obviously, it's good that we are shifting away from these really old-fashioned and dirty forms of finding energy.
Dirty is the right word there.
But in terms of renewable, I mean, are they including nuclear in that? Because in terms of what the policy of the government has been since, especially since Theresa May has greenlit a lot of the proposal, it has been moving towards nuclear energy rather than true clean energy, looking into hydro electricity and solar and wind possibilities, etc. I mean, obviously, that comes with its own risk. In fact, where I'm from, there's going to be the Hinkley Point power point being built down there. Obviously, that comes with a lot of economic benefits, but that comes with danger, because that's the nature of a nuclear plant. Obviously, the danger is probably going to be the risks of that going wrong is probably a million, billion, squillion to one. But the danger is present. And there is, in terms of damage to the environment, sorting out the waste that comes from that, the amount that could be potentially polluted into nearby sea or rivers or whatever. For me, I want to know exactly how far the government's commitment to true renewable energy is and what they are conflating renewable energy with nuclear.
That's a very interesting statement, because I just read the article, thought it was very positive, and went away happy. But now you've just completely
so
screwed my vision of it and made me feel, oh no, we're all going to nuclear? Oh, that was my happy story of the day. But yeah, no, I think, I mean, now it's curveballed me there. I think if it is going to nuclear, then why? Why are we not looking at more green, efficient power sources? I mean, I know they're not as cost efficient as nuclear power would be.
But the thing is, recently, I think Portugal and Germany both managed full days just using renewable. That's not including nuclear. That's not including any fossil fuels. They powered themselves purely on nuclear, on renewable energy sources. So to say that we are decades or years behind being able to find a viable way of incorporating renewable energy sources into the hub of the of our energy usage, I think is an old-fashioned argument. We have nowadays, we're seeing that it is possible, even if it is just for one or two days, that it is possible to run completely on renewable energy. So to say that nuclear is the most effective way forward, it's a pretty permanent solution, because that plant's going to be there, the waste that they're going to put off is going to be there,
yeah,
and the radioactive materials that they use are going to be there. So to not want to invest in something which has proved itself that it is beginning to show true signs of potential, and go for something which is permanent but has its own risks, is almost baffling.
I mean, I think actually in this article, it does say that the UK's largest power station, which is called Drax, apparently, has actually upgraded half of the station to run on sustainable biomass. I don't know if that's particularly cost effective or anything. I don't actually, as I said, I don't know that much about the environment or about energy. But again, anything better than coal really is a thing of the past. We're not in the industrial era anymore. And we really need to give our world a new lease of life.
Yeah, and with the Paris Agreement, just come in. Do you think it is apt now that Theresa May should be looking at people like Germany and things to go forward and create these renewable energies? Do you think we should, as citizens, should push her towards that? Or do you think we should just let her figure it out for herself? Do you think there should be a petition or something like that?
Yeah, I think any pressures wanted. I mean, as I think I mentioned last week, Paris Agreement isn't actually binding. There are lots of issues
exactly.
with its enforcement. And I can't remember if it's today or the next few days, there's another global climate conference. And that will be when we get the true test of what the Paris Agreement actually does. And again, this all links together, apparently, because Donald Trump is obviously very against climate change. And as the new head of one of the biggest polluters in the world, that might signal doom for this agreement.
Yeah.
But as I say, it's not a binding agreement, so we should put all pressure we can on the government. Well, maybe I'm not going to go out knocking on doors to get people to sign up to a newsletter.
Why not? Why are you campaigning?
I'm a pretty lazy man. I
think that's gone. What
I was just going to say, yeah. I really hope that our government does a sensible thing.
Yeah, and, me too. I think, yeah. Especially with the now Trump legacy beginning, I think it's precedented that we need to lead by example and get rid of all this nuclear and coal and replace it with renewable energy.
This is URN The Pulse.
I have a story now about Brexit, and after all this Donald Trump nonsense, Brexit has kind of, for the first time ever, been below on the actual headlines in newspapers, but a development has come today, and it's quite an interesting one, actually. The European Parliament is to review a proposal for an associate EU citizenship open to nationals of a country that has left the Union but who want to stay part of the European project and retain some of their EU rights. The plan, tabled by a Liberal MEP from Luxembourg, could mean British citizens who opt for the new status will be able to continue to travel freely and live on the continent, rights that may no longer be automatic after Brexit. It's clear the UK is divided and many people want to remain part of Europe, said Charles Gurrans, who proposed Amendment 8082 on possible changes to the current institutional setup of the European Union. The idea is simply to guarantee those who want it some of the same rights they had as full EU citizens, including the right of residence in the EU and be able to vote in European elections and be represented by an MEP. Now, last month, The Guardian reported a huge rise in the number of Britons seeking citizenship in other EU countries, with at least 2,800 Britons across 18 countries applying to secure their post-Brexit status in the first 8 months of 2016, an increase of more than 250% on numbers recorded in 2015, so that's quite a high figure. The amendment, for which Gurrans hopes to find wide parliamentary backing and which MEPs could vote on early in the new year, proposes a European associate citizenship for those who feel and wish to be part of the European project but are nationals of a former member state. The amendment suggests that associate citizenship should offer these associate citizens the rights of freedom of movement and to reside on its territory, as well as being represented in the Parliament through a vote in the European elections on the European list. The UK government's insistence on control of EU immigration as one of the top priorities makes it highly likely that under a future reciprocal Brexit deal, British citizens will no longer enjoy the automatic right to travel freely, live and work across the continent. Gurrans said he had been taken aback by the level of support he'd received for the proposal. This has clearly struck a chord, he said. A lot of people from Britain have got in touch with me to ask what they can do to make sure it happens. So guys, what do you think? Would you get this associate citizenship? Or do you think that Brexit should just be Brexit?
I don't think anyone here wants a hard Brexit. I think we all want some form. I think Brexit should happen. I think that's the way democracy has gone.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want it to have that much of an impact on me. And I think that this is an excellent way of mitigating that impact. I've realised recently I've been pretty lax in not actually having done my due diligence in travelling to all these EU countries.
Yeah.
I've not done the classic road trip or whatever. And I'm missing out. And I don't want to be able to, I don't want to be prevented from doing that by Brexit and by our removal from the EU. And from the free movement of people. I think this is an excellent way to make sure that we are still able to enjoy that. The only issue is that I don't see what the EU would get in return, and that's what these negotiations are looking for. They're looking for both sides are trying to take a hard stance to get the best deal, and they both need the best deal. And with freebies like this offered up, it's not entirely sure that this will be accepted by the EU establishment, as it were.
I mean, this isn't suggested by a British citizen. This is suggested by a Luxembourg citizen, German citizen even, not Luxembourg. He has suggested this and has said to Germany that we should open our arms to the British people. However, I mean, I would definitely sign up for one, but I know there'd be a lot of anger about this because it is, in a way, kind of going back on some parts of Brexit that people did vote for to be out of. What do you think, Lewis?
It is literally having our cake and eat it.
Yeah, exactly.
If they offered it me, I would be, yes, please, by Felicia. But in terms of it actually happening, it seems it is basically a backdoor way of Britain securing freedom of movement, but one way freedom of movement. It wouldn't be in the EU's best interest in terms of taking a hard stance. It wouldn't be in the EU's interest of wanting to come out as the better, the one that survived better, if you like. I can't really think of a better way of putting it.
Like out of a relationship, the one that's
the one that won the divorce. But it's tricky because obviously The EU is a project that's very, it's quite ideological. There's lots of ideals behind it.
Yeah.
It's about common citizenship and working together in community. But at the end of the day, politics exists. And if the EU wants to do this, then that's fine. But it would be perceived as the British being able to once again have an opt-out clause of the decisions that they've made.
So do you think that this would encourage other countries to take the same stance that Britain did, if they can see that they can still get these rights?
I mean, that's a good point, actually, because as we're learning, there are rising kind of right-wing and nationalistic forces mm-hmm. in many countries, especially in Europe. I mean, just for an example, France has got its elections coming up in the, what is it, the National Front? I can't remember what they're called.
Yeah, it's a woman, isn't it?
Marine Le Pen.
Mm-hmm. Marine Le Pen, yeah.
She's got a lot of support, and that's only going to increase after, again, Donald Trump. But the EU and the people in charge of the EU, like Jean-Claude Juncker, are very definitely going to want to crack down on potential nations abandoning ship from the EU. That's not what the EU is about. Us leaving was terrible. Any more would be a disaster. Absolute disaster. Mm-hmm. And something like this, which would only make it more attractive for countries to leave and also to just enjoy the benefits of the EU without putting anything in, as you say, having a cake and eating it. I don't think this will gain any, as lovely as it would be, I don't think it'll gain any support from the mainstream EU politicians.
Do you think it will gain support from our politicians? Now, see, Theresa May wanted a hard Brexit, didn't she? She wanted to stand for one anyway.
I think that's interesting because I think we would be definitely, I think our politicians would want whatever deal could get, like the best deal, and this is just a plus for us. But I think our politicians are probably realistic in knowing that it's, you got to have something in trade, really.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be higher priorities in regards to the mandate that the British people gave. As you say, Theresa May has taken that mandate to be quite a hard version of Brexit. And this is some kind of manifestation of a very soft form.
Yeah.
Maintaining, being still part of the free movement of people. Well, that needs to go both ways. And as we know, immigration was a massive deal for people who did vote to leave. So I really don't think that she'll want to trade that in response to this. And I don't think it has much future, really.
So out of the, shall I say, decency to protect the rest of the EU, should we reject this plan instead of fuel this single MEP who has had lots of British support in enforcing this plan?
I don't think it's up to us to reject it, really.
No? Do you think we should just try and get our cake and eat it? And
no,
then...
I don't necessarily think we should push for it either. I think this is a case for the European Parliament. It's not really a case for Westminster or things here. If they want to vote on it, great. If it gives us a benefit, I'm not... Personally, if it happens, I'll be like, yes, please. But yeah. I think it's up to the European Union and the European Parliament to decide whether that's something they're interested in. If it ends up that they pass it and using that becomes some sort of leverage for British politicians to get a better deal or know that they have something in their pocket, then that's what's happened. But I don't think it will make much of a splash in Westminster regardless.
Well,
I think part of the issue actually is that it's it could be seen as a form of negotiation, and as we all know, we're not allowed to negotiate with the EU until we've actually left.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably will just be shot completely out of the gate, really.
So we'll just sit back and see if we get our cake and eat it, shall we?
The Pulse, the news that matters to you.
We have had a text in about the previous topic about Brexit, and someone said, I assume that the benefit to the EU is Labour and students. Moreover, rather than being a particularly petty institutions and punishing the nearly 50% of voters who wish to remain in the EU, rather they would be seen as taking the high road and being in the best interest in its citizens rather than as a power-grabbing political machine. It could actually improve their reputation across those other countries, e.g. France, who are considering their positions in the EU at the moment. What do you guys think about that? I think that's very interesting.
I think it's a bit more of a coherent point than any of us made.
Yeah.
I do think that's true, actually. But it's not just Labour and students going out to the EU, is it, from our country? Historically, it's always been more people from the EU coming in. That's my understanding anyway. And the people who do go out from our country is mostly, well, there's lots of tourists, which is obviously good, but they would definitely, I think the EU would definitely want a two-way kind of thing there. And as we say, that's not really on the cards for Theresa May and her hardline Brexit.
Like I said, feel free to text in about that story or any of the stories we talked about today. But now we're going to go a little bit lighter. Have a little bit of a laugh after the horrible news that we've had today. And we will go on to a story about China having a mall where you can drop off your husbands.
Indeed, yeah. This is a story from Mashable, the website Mashable. It's a shopping centre in Shanghai. They've opened a husband nursery. So it's a mall in Shanghai called Vanke Mall. They opened a husband nursery over the weekend. And it encourages people to deposit, in quotation marks, deposit husbands there whilst they shop. The nursery has comfy chairs, a television, a fully stocked fridge, even a massage chair. What was interesting in the article is that it said that the Chinese translation of the service was literally the husband's storage room. In terms of the social media reaction in the Chinese social networks such as Weibo, it's seen positive and negative feedback. For example, positive reactions have been, they can see that there's a baby chair there. My compliments, said one frustrated wife. And another said, another husband said, I wouldn't be afraid to be dragged along to the mall by my wife if I could be there. Others had a little bit more of a negative outlook on it. One person said that it spoils the shopping experience and defeats the purpose of a day out together as a couple or a family. And one woman said, is there a wife nursery? I don't like shopping. So in terms of what's interesting actually for me on a slightly more serious note is that does it spoil the shopping experience? Does it defeat the purpose of a day out together? Or is this just accepting what is true in a large amount of cases that one person doesn't want to be there and one person does want to go shopping?
I mean, I've just seen Stefan's face like crumble up when you said day out shopping.
Go to his charge.
But no, I have been told that I do take too long to shop. So female and male friends alike always complain and say, you know, can we go somewhere else while you look at this one dress for half an hour and decide whether you're going to buy it? So, I mean, the nursery might be quite a good idea for me because my friends don't want to sit there and wait for me to try on endless outfits in the changing rooms and then take pictures of all of them and send them to my friends, decide whether I kind of want them or not.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, anything to alleviate the boredom. My friends also spend hours in the changing room and I just do anything to get out of being there, really. But I think it does defeat the point of a day out together, really. If one half's locked in a room with other people and one's out shopping, it does really defeat the point.
I mean, I don't think they're locked in there. But it's just a place to stay.
Yeah. Locked away.
Well, it is the husband's storage room, so, you know.
I'd love to do that. I think that's excellent. There's been too many times when, you know, you've been walking around with someone and they've got stuff they need to do. That's fair. But you don't. You're just there for whatever reason. You've got what you need. And I think that's an excellent way just to sit down and actually be catered to. I love that.
Do you guys think it's fair that it's the husband nursery and not the general fed up with shopping people nursery?
I mean, I think it's playing on the stereotype that husbands don't like to shop and that wives tend to shop a little bit more than husbands do for certain items. Whereas men, statistically, I think from what I've talked about in the polls previous sessions, that men seem to go round shops quicker, going only necessary things, and that's not all men, that's a statistic. And I mean, I think it's playing on stereotype. I don't exactly agree with it. I think they probably should have just said waiting room or something like that, maybe.
Very clinical.
Yeah, waiting room. Well, yeah, that's quite clinical. So maybe fun space or something like that, maybe. I don't
that's
know.
That's a bit inappropriate.
maybe not that.
So for you guys, what would be in your ultimate husband/wife/bored person nursery?
I would have the football on. They didn't mention the football being on the telly.
I mean, they have the telly. I mean, it could be whatever channel you desire.
I feel like I could sit there for hours watching the football, so that would do me. Massage chair is always good as well. I mean, it would be good if they had a way of shopping while sitting down in there. I mean, that's me being completely lazy.
Don't you call that online shopping? Yeah.
Well, this
you're is describing like a lounge at home. I don't understand.
Yeah, but they could bring you the shopping so that you didn't have to, you know, wait around at your house for a certain parcel or something.
I mean, people do bring shopping to your house as well.
It's called Argos. Well, I don't know.
Okay, right. Guys. It's a suggestion. Okay, leave me alone.
I don't know. I
think, what would you have in there?
What would I have in there? Games console, maybe. I like the fully stocked fridge. If there's a microwave and an oven and that sort
of
stuff.
Oh, you're set.
I don't know.
Fire hazard, just, though, a little bit.
Okay, they cook for me. But like, I don't know. I mean, I'm all for the stocked fridge, but, you know.
Becky, how about you?
I'm with Lewis. I'm completely sold on the food idea.
I feel like I'm going to keep upgrading it until we eventually get, you know, full gym, residential suite, luxury beds. It'd be fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's a potential idea, isn't it? It's China. They do tend to go big when they do things, and I'd like, yeah.
Living could, in a shopping centre.
It could, well, this is
every
the thing.
Child's dream.
This could be it. This could be the development of the house mall.
Imagine how busy it get over the Christmas period.
Really. Oh, God, like, yeah.
It'd have to be a queue for the queuing place.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because in Liverpool, where I visit regularly, because my dad's a Scouser, unfortunately. No, I love him. I love Liverpool. I'm really proud of the city. But every time you walk past Primark around Christmas time, there's always thousands of husbands just sat outside, you know, maybe with their iPads trying to watch football or reading a newspaper, looking really bored, because all their wives spend hours. Amanda Michelle is really guilty for it. She can be in there 5 hours. Absolute ages.
This is disgusting.
I know. So
those poor men crying out
they're
from
all sat
chair.
Outside, so I'm sure they would love this idea in Liverpool. In fact, if China gets sick of it, send it to Liverpool. I'm sure it'll do really well there.
So we'll see if it catches on. We'll see.
We will see.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting to follow it in maybe in a couple of weeks. You can report back to us and see
live
how it's
stream
done.
On YouTube.
Yeah. There you go. There's another direction. Gogglebox.
It's just this one shop at the moment, or is
this
it
is well, it's the Vanke Mall in Shanghai. So I think it's just one shopping centre at the moment. But I mean, if laziness catches on, then it could could become a worldwide concept.
This is URN, the Pulse.